Thank you, Rabbi.
Oh, is that right?
It's really always a pleasure to be here. So what do you want to talk about?
Well, I've had this thing of trying to press that Yom Kippur is a very joyous day. But on the surface, experientially, for most people, just that idea is a novel idea, because we think of it more like a Tisha B'Av than a festivity.
I think your question is an excellent question, because on the surface, Yom Kippur should be a very joyous day, because in two places in the Talmud, it says explicitly, and I quote, "Lo hayu yamim tovim liYisrael," there were no happier and better days for the Jewish people, and one of the two is Yom Kippur. It doesn't say that about Sukkot, which, as you know, in davening is called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our happiness. It doesn't say that about Pesach. It says it about Yom Kippur and the 15th of Av. Leaving the 15th of Av out of our conversation, why is indeed Yom Kippur such a joyous day? And allow me to buttress the question. If, unfortunately, someone's sitting Shiva before Yom Kippur, what's the law?
Shiva stops.
What's the law if Shiva comes into Shabbos? You stop for Shabbos partially, and you continue.
Yeah.
So Yom Kippur is definitely more joyous than Shabbos. The problem is that many a times the fast blinds us, because for us, the fast is the main thing that diminishes our joy. Because for us, Jews, we always associate holidays with eating. Namely, they tried to kill us, they were not successful.
Let's eat.
That's a typical Jewish holiday. That's what they teach people in conversion courses. That Judaism is about eating, and therefore, how can you have a holiday without eating? And the question is, how is Yom Kippur supposed to be joyous if we're not eating, despite all the evidence that it is joyous? More than that, the Gemara says in a different place that every single Shabbos or holiday, you're supposed to do a few things to make it special. You're supposed to eat and drink, and you're supposed to wear nicer clothing. Those are the three main elements to make the day different. Namely, on a Sunday, you wear certain clothing. When it comes to a Shabbos or Yom Tov, you change that clothing, and that's what makes the day into a special day. Then we overeat, and that makes it into even a more special day. And then the services in synagogue are even longer, and that makes it special. So Yom Kippur is at a minus. What's the problem on Yom Kippur? It is a holiday. We're supposed to make it special, and yet we can't eat and drink, says the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos. Therefore, you have to wear more clothing on Yom Kippur than you do on a regular holiday. How do we fulfill that in synagogue? We put on a kittel and a talis when? Not just in the morning services, as we do all year, but at Kol Nidre and at Mincha. Now, why do we do that? So when I was a kid, they called me because it's a day of davening. Very nice answer, by the way. I don't know if it's true or not. But that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says because we have to up the clothing because we've diminished the eating and the drinking. So putting all these three proofs together, it cancels pre-existing mourning. The Gemara says that lo hayu yamim tovim liYisrael, there were nicer, happier days than Yom Kippur. And the fact that you have to up the clothing to make it into a nice day, not to mention the white clothing, not to mention the fact that we light all the lights in the synagogue, all in the code of Jewish law. This all proves it's a happy day. But says the rabbi, with due respect, we feel the fast. We don't feel the happiness. More than that, if you look at the services, if you ask people, what synonym to Yom Kippur, beyond fasting, what would they say? They won't say happiness.
No, it's a solemn day.
Serious sin. Right. Solemn, serious, three words with S. Solemn, serious sin. Right? We sinned here, we sinned there, etc. And that's the way we perceive Yom Kippur. And the question is, how do you take these three pieces of evidence amongst many others and make it into, and say it's a happy day? I'm going to suggest something this evening.
Also, how do you change the concept of fast on Tisha B'Av to the fast on Yom Kippur?
And there's no question that halachically they're different.
Yeah.
On Yom Kippur, the fast, on Tisha B'Av, the fast stems from it being a day of mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. Not a day of solemnity. Not a day of getting closer to God, but actually a day that we're far from God. Therefore, in the services, we barely daven. We say keynote lamentations. We kvetch a lot. We cry a lot. We do not daven a lot. If you look at the services on Tisha B'Av, we've diminished the service again and again and again and again because it's not a day of davening. And I'll give you one proof. Have you heard of Ne'ilah? Of course you heard of Ne'ilah.
Once or twice. Mm-hmm.
Now, most Jews think Ne'ilah is associated with Yom Kippur. The Gemara, and this is the halacha, Ne'ilah is supposed to be part and parcel of every fast day. However, what we call a fast day is not what the fast day is called in Jewish law. Jewish law says a fast day has to start at night and end at night. So we basically have two left, Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. Why don't we say Ne'ilah and Tisha B'Av? After all, they're very similar, as the rabbi says. We both, on both night to night, we don't eat and drink. Night to night, no leather shoes, right? How come we don't say Ne'ilah and Tisha B'Av? Because Tisha B'Av is a day that symbolizes God not accepting our prayers. So you don't add more prayers on a day that God doesn't accept prayers. So Yom Kippur, by corollary, is a day that God accepts prayers, and we add Ne'ilah. It's the only day of the year, as a matter of fact, that's left. So how do we feel happiness on Yom Kippur? I'm going to suggest something tonight. Actually, two suggestions. One is more spiritual, the other is more practical. I like to be practical, so I'm not going to leave everything in the spiritual realm. But I'll start with it. It's the one day a year you outdo yourselves. You know what outdo yourselves means? It's the one day a year you can be like an angel and get through it. On the day of Yom Kippur, there's no big difference between an angel and you. Think about it. An angel eats and drinks? No, and neither do you. An angel doesn't wear leather shoes, and neither do you. An angel stands for most of all his life, and so do you for most of the davening. There's not much on Yom Kippur that differentiates and makes a distinction between an angel and you. It's a day where the Jewish people outdo themselves on a spiritual realm. Think about what you do on Yom Kippur. At the end of the day, you could say, at this moment, Ne'ilah, I'm hungry. My head is hurting because of my caffeine withdrawal. Yes, I know of that meal after the fast, but at this moment, there's not much that makes a distinction between me and an angel. It's a day in which you reach spiritual heights that outdoes your spiritual heights all year. I'd say more than that. All year long, we're limited in our spiritual heights simply because we eat and we drink and we have things that take us away from that. I mean, even if davening in the morning is great and wonderful, Shabbos morning, it really was nice here in Or Tzion. But there's the Kiddush afterwards. I mean, that's it.
We're always looking at
the time. Bets are off. You don't look at your watch on Yom Kippur. What are you going to look at your watch for? To go take a nap? And how long would your nap going to be for? And you'll wake up hungry. So at the end of the day, it's a day in which the Jewish people say, wow, we can get to spiritual heights we can't get to any other day of the year, and that's the happiness on Yom Kippur. It's a day in which you can pat yourselves on the back and say, God created me flesh and blood and spiritual. Correct? God created us, on the one hand, like many of the mammal world, much of the world that's out there of animalistic traits we have, and at the same time we have a spiritual side called the divine image. And guess what? If on Rosh Hashanah God created the human being, on Yom Kippur we take the divine image and barely take care of the physical side. As a matter of fact, it's barely there at all. And therefore, that's the happiness of Yom Kippur. You can pat yourselves on the back. We did it. We went to the highest level that a human being can get to on earth, to the extent that at Ne'ilah there's no difference between you and an angel.
So why?
But that's very spiritual. I don't want to leave it there. Yeah.
Yeah, but you say we're being judged. Who's going to be raised up? Who's going to be lowered down? I mean, it's like, oh, it's a nice day out, but I'm going to the principal's office. This may not be so good for me.
And indeed, let's take care of that. Let's add to that. We talk a lot about sin. And all the sins we did. So very nice to be spiritual and reach heights, but somehow the davening reminds us, Brian says all the time, of the sins and the shortcomings and the principal's office. So very nice to great spiritual heights, but somehow we're taken down. My answer to that is that indeed, when you reach spiritual heights, you have to say, but I did this and I did that wrong. It's very nice to say that, you know, I just ran from here to there, but I'm out of breath because I'm not keeping in shape. because I eat too much cake. You know, it's very nice to say, I just did a few jumping jacks, but only did 10 and not 12 because I'm out of breath. So Yom Kippur sort of absolutely gets you to the spiritual heights, but you're still reminded of your shortcomings. Right?
Or is there a natural extension?
Now I'm going to talk about the shortcomings, because the first answer I gave...
Why don't we teach this at an earlier age? Why do I have to get to my...
Because at an early... I think you're asking a very good question. I'm going to answer you. Okay. At an earlier age, I believe, Mr. Nadell, that they teach us Judaism at a very primitive state, because our minds are not developed yet. Yeah. And I don't blame them for that. And then comes the problem.
I want to
now you're 12, you're 13. Your mind's developing. You know? And you're not reading a newspaper article like you used to. Your mind developed. You're not going ahead and looking at girls and girls at boys the way you used to. You're developing. And yet when it comes to your spiritual Jewish life, it stops. And that's a big problem. And I don't understand why it stops. And how come, even at the age of 16, my perception at least was, God is this mad God that's constantly waiting to throw a fire at you every time you do a sin. And Yom Kippur is a day in which you go into the laundry machine. You go into the washing machine, dirty, and you come out clean. And that's your perception of Yom Kippur. And the most important thing on Yom Kippur is not to be hungry and thirsty, or to be more precise, be hungry and thirsty, not complain about it. And it's unfortunate, but that's the way we educate children. In other words, when they're children, I understand why you educate them simply. But when we develop, our spirituality and our Jewish life should develop with it. And I don't understand why not. But Brian asked a very good question. After all, the sins are constantly there. Who shall live and who shall die and who's at the end and who's going to be hungry? How do you feel spiritually? You feel very down if that's what the davening is talking about. So therefore, I want to give a second answer. Even though I think the first answer is legitimate, that you reach spiritual heights you never do, I want to give another answer that I think is very true. Yom Kippur is a day of total unity within the Jewish people. We don't have days like this at all in the calendar. Much to my dismay. What do I mean? There's three things that happen on Erev Yom Kippur that don't happen throughout the year. We fix our relationship with God. We fix our relationship with the family. And we fix our relationship with each other. Let's start with the last one. The Code of Jewish Law says that on Erev Yom Kippur, we should go from person to person and ask forgiveness if we fouled someone. Namely, you don't have to go to someone that you're very friendly with and say, I'm sorry if I hurt you. If you didn't hurt, then there's no reason to say, I'm sorry if I hurt you. You know what happens then. What do you mean you're sorry you hurt me? You did something behind my back? What did you do? So that you don't have to do. But if you know for a fact that you fouled someone, that you did something that's not nice, you should ask for forgiveness on Erev Yom Kippur. So the first thing we do is we fix our relationship with each other. You come into shul, you look around, everyone in this shul, I'm at peace with. Why? Because on Erev Yom Kippur, I spent my time fixing it. Next. The Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva was this amazing person. We know everything about Rabbi Akiva. He's one of the scholars in the Talmud. We know when he was born. We know for the first 40 years of his life, he didn't learn anything. He hated rabbis. Mm-hmm. That didn't change much in the Jewish people. I know many people that hated rabbis. But I don't know anyone like Rabbi Akiva who said, if I see a rabbi, I'll bite him. Quote. At 40, transformation. He went to yeshiva. He became one of the biggest scholars of the Jewish people. We all know what his wife's name was, Rachel. We even know the piece of jewelry he bought his wife. You know what it was called? Yerushalayim, Shel, Zahav. Naomi Shemer took it right off of that. We know his wife's name, Rachel. So if the Talmud invests so much time into Rabbi Akiva, obviously he saw him as an important rabbi. It says about Rabbi Akiva, he would stay in the study hall all day and night. He came home to sleep, he went in the morning. That's where he was. Except for 2 days a year, he came home early. Erev Pesach, we'll leave that for a different lecture. And Erev Yom Kippur. Why didn't he come home Erev Yom Kippur, says the Gemara? Kedei la'chil et b'neihem, to feed the kids. Does anyone understand that statement? I didn't understand it till a year ago. Well, let's assume he wanted to help his wife for a change. That's nice. First of all, that's important. But more important, why do you have to feed the kids? They're not fasting on Yom Kippur. We're not talking about feed the kids that are fasting. We're talking about feed the kids that are not obligated yet to fast. Up until 9, you're not obligated to fast at all. As a matter of fact, it has no significance. 2 years before your 2 years before your bar mitzvah, meaning 4 years, you should educate children to fast a little bit on Yom Kippur, a few hours. Namely, if they usually eat dinner at 8, maybe they'll eat dinner at 9. Something along those lines. 2 years before their bar bat mitzvah, they should really try to fast the whole day if they physically can. If they can't, they shouldn't. But suffice it to say that Rabbi Akiva, who was not home all year for dinner time, did not have to come home Erev Yom Kippur to remind Mrs. Akiva, named Rachel, to feed the kids. First of all, they're eating anyway on Yom Kippur. And secondly, all year long he didn't feel that he needs to come home early. So why did he come home early on Erev Yom Kippur?
He's trying to make that connection and apology to his children.
He's trying to reconcile the relationship with his children. And therefore he came home and he said, "Today I am here to serve you dinner." I mean, it would be very strange to me if my kids all of a sudden saw me in the kitchen cooking. And they'd say, "What are you cooking?" "I'm cooking you dinner." "You're cooking me dinner?" My wife, Tali, always says, "You want to help me? You want to make the food delicious? The most important thing you should do is stay away from the kitchen." All of a sudden, you're in the kitchen? Why? Answer, I want to fix the relationship not just with every Jew in shul. I want to fix my relationship with my family. And then comes the third thing we do on Erev Yom Kippur. So we fixed our relationship with each other and our family. What do we do at Mincha before Yom Kippur? It's a regular Mincha, Ashrei, Amida, right?
We read this morning.
Nope. What do? We do the Vidu. We say Al Chet before Yom Kippur. Before the onset of Yom Kippur. Why? Various reasons are given. And if you didn't say it before Mincha, then maybe you should say it right before Kol Nidre as well. You're going to do it all Yom Kippur. Why? So that you can come before God clean as well. God, if I did something wrong, I want to clean it up even before Yom Kippur. A separate lecture, so why do we repeat it on Yom Kippur? But think about this. On Erev Yom Kippur, you clean up your relationship first and foremost with your family, second of all with each other, and thirdly with God. So now you came to Kol Nidre, and you are in unity with your family, your community, and with God. And just in case you think I'm crazy, and I just made this up, what is the first statement out of the Chazan's mouth on Yom Kippur night? What's the name of the Chazan in the synagogue? I met him.
Jeffrey.
Jeff. What is this first statement?
Oy vey.
Yeah?
No, I don't know.
I hope not. No, right before Kol Nidre.
Okay to
you're close. Cheryl's close. Before Kol Nidre, we say Al Da'at HaMakom.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Val Da'at HaKahal. Be Yeshiva Shomar, Be Yeshiva Shomata. Let's leave that out. Anu Matirin Lihitpalel. We allow to daven Im Ha'a sinners. Now you're at peace and in unity with the sinners, what you perceive as sinners. You're at unity with them. Namely, you come into shul and you say, you know, all year long I come in and I say, I'm a better guy than him. I come to shul Friday night and Shabbos. He only comes Shabbos morning. I come on time. He comes an hour late. I don't talk during services. He does. What's the first statement out of your mouth on Yom Kippur night? I am allowing to daven with the sinners. As a matter of fact, either we're all sinners or we're all tzaddikim. There's no differences here in the synagogue tonight. We are unified. We spend the whole day being unified with our family, our community, and with God. And there's one entity left. What we perceive as sinners, they're also welcomed in. So think about how a Jew gets to Yom Kippur. Total unity with the Jewish people. Total unity. That's the celebration on Yom Kippur. Because think about the entire Yom Kippur. What makes a distinction between you and me and any other Jew? The majority of Jews are where on Yom Kippur? In shul.
Sure.
Forget about what kind of shul they go to. They are in shul or they're at home feeling guilty they're not at shul. I have met Jews that for some reason or another had a business trip or something, and they felt guilty for not being in synagogue. They don't go all year, but they felt guilty not to be there on Yom Kippur. There's no distinction. Either you're in shul or you're guilty not being there. That's not the case on a typical Shabbos. Sukkot, the first day, is going to be this year, Monday. You think Jews out there are going to go to work and say, oh, yeah, I feel guilty I'm not in shul eating in a sukkah? Halavai, we should get to that. We're not there yet. But on Yom Kippur, we're there. What makes a difference? We're in total unity. More than that, some people come into shul with expensive shoes. Others come in with cheap shoes, like me. Some people go to the nice stores, buy a nice pair of shoes. I go to Walmart. I get the cheapest shoes. Within 6 months, there's holes in them. I get another pair. I think I'm getting a deal. I'm really not. That's me. But another person has expensive shoes. Yom Kippur, what kind of shoes do you wear? The most richest Jew in the shul and the cheapest Jew in the shul? Well,
non-leather
shoes. No difference in shoes. No difference, as a matter of fact, in wardrobe. What do you wear on Yom Kippur?
Kittel.
A kittel. And what do women wear? The Shulchan Aruch Paskins, the Mishnah Brewer, pardon me, says women should also wear white on Yom Kippur, not just men. It's a day of atonement for everyone. Nope. So we all wear white. What's the difference in dress code? All right, some people don't wear white, but in general, you go into a shul, you see white.
Is there a custom not to wear jewelry?
There is a custom like that. I don't think it's widespread, though.
Makeup and
it just follows a similar concept, though, that idea.
The general idea is that there's no difference between us. We're wearing basically the same kinds of shoes. Mm-hmm. We're wearing the basically same wardrobe. And quite frankly, there's no difference between sinners and non-sinners. We invited them right in. We're at peace with our family. We're at peace with each other. We're at peace with God. What's the difference between us? And now you can understand the custom of Yom Kippur that distincts Yom Kippur from every other day of the year in the prayer service. So we have special services for Yom Kippur. We all know that. But certain parts we say every day. And all of them are the same. Meaning, if you said this morning, Baruch She'amar, you're going to say it on Yom Kippur. There's no difference in the Baruch She'amar. It's said on Yom Kippur like it said this morning. Namely, Baruch She'amar, Yachid Che'olamim, and that's it. You know the difference between an Ashkenazi chazan and a Sephardic chazan. A Sephardic chazan says every single word. Word for word. An Ashkenazi chazan is a traffic light. He tells you when to stop and when to go. Right? So it's said on Yom Kippur like it said this morning. You want to change the tune, you change the tune. But other than that, it's the same thing. Now take the part of the prayer service that you say every day that we change. What am I talking about? What is the one thing on Yom Kippur that we say every day, twice a day, and on Yom Kippur we say it differently? Huge change, as a matter of fact. Let's go back to grade school when they taught us that God is a scary God and Yom Kippur is his day of atonement where you're supposed to feel bad. Like Woody Allen said in the famous movie, Radio Days. Remember that movie?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where he sits at home, remember, on Yom Kippur? What are you supposed to do all day? Right. You're supposed to sit here and think about how terrible you are and your sins. No? At that time, they taught us that when you say Shema, you say Shema Yisrael, blah, blah, blah. No. Why do we say it out loud? So the Gemara says, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he said the Torah, he didn't say it out loud. He didn't say it at all, as a matter of fact. So we shouldn't say it at all. But at a reference of Yaakov, who said it, we say it quietly. Why on Yom Kippur do we say it out loud? The Gemara says, the story with Yaakov. This is what happened. Yaakov's about to die. All his kids are around his deathbed. And he was about to tell them a prophecy. And all of a sudden, he went blank. So he said, I'm not going senile here. God took away the prophecy. Maybe one of you is a sinner, is assimilating, is intermarrying. After all, in my family tradition, said Yaakov, I got pretty high failure rates. Let's think about this. Avraham Avinu, Avraham our forefather, the very first Jew, he had a bunch of children, but his two primary children, Yitzchak and Yishmael, one assimilated, one did it. That's 50% kids assimilated. Then in my family, said Yaakov, it was me, and my brother Esav. Esav? Whoo! Off the path. So maybe I have 12 kids and one daughter. Maybe one of you assimilated. Maybe one of you are thinking of intermarrying. What do they say? Shema Yisrael. Listen, Israel. Yaakov's other name was Israel. Hashem Elokeinu, God is our God. Hashem Echad, God is one. We believe in God just like you. Yaakov is so happy. Everyone is united in their belief of God. He says the words, Baruch Shem Kvod Malchuto Leolam Voed. Tell me, if that's the story, why do we say it out loud on Yom Kippur? Because what other day of the year can you say all the Jews are united? What, on Shabbos? On Shabbos, you're in shul. And you know how many empty seats there are in shul, and how many seats can be filled with Jews who are at the office, didn't feel like coming, went golfing, went over here, went over there, went up, went down. As a good congregant, already in the better world, used to tell me, always blame the weather because of lack of shul attendance. Mm-hmm. If it's too hot, it's too hot to come to shul. If it's too cold, it's too cold to come to shul. If it's rainy, it's too rainy to come to shul. Now, what happens when you have a rare Shabbos morning where it's perfect? It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's not rainy, it's not snowy. It's perfect. Why don't Jews come to shul?
Because of the weather.
Because the weather is perfect. Why would you want to come to shul for?
Now they're praying for bad weather.
That's all year long. That's even on the holidays of the year. I can't even say Pesach. You could say most of the Jews keep a Seder, not all. There's one day a year that all the Jews are united, either in shul or feeling guilty not to be in shul. Fasting at home or fasting in shul, I would even say more. If they're not fasting, they're embarrassed to tell you. Which day? Yom Kippur. December 25th. Yom Kippur. So the happiness of Yom Kippur, in my opinion, is not just you've gained spiritual heights. You're united with all the Jewish people. If you prepare properly for Yom Kippur, you're at peace with each other, with God, and with your family, and with the sinners. And therefore you can say Baruch Shem Kvod, because it's the only day that all the people around the Bet Yaakov are united. The only day of the year we're united in our dress code, in our shoes, and in our behavior. So, if that's the case, says Brian, what about the constant reminder of sin that we say in the services everywhere? The answer is, because you want to be united and be at one with God, you're still reminded of that time I fractured this law and I fractured that law. The more you admit it, the more you'll be at peace with God. You'll be at such peace with God that the more you'll say, Al-Chayt, 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 you're at such peace with God, you're honest with God and say, God, I have a few achievements this year, I also have a few sins this year. I'd like you to forgive me for it. All of us fall. All of us fail. I was taught as a young rabbi, you know what you do when the congregant goes ahead and complains, how come you didn't visit me in the hospital? And how come you didn't call me when I was sick? What should be your answer? So colloquial knowledge says you give excuses. I was away. I didn't know. My cell phone's battery died. My email all of a sudden didn't work. You know what the best answer should be?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. No excuses. I'm sorry. Whatever happened, happened. I'm sorry. It won't happen again. Then you're at peace with that individual, hopefully, if he has a forgiving heart. Usually I say he, because she does have a forgiving heart. He? You never know. So gentlemen and ladies, I believe that the constant mention of sin has to be buttressed with the constant mention of all the other stuff in davening that they forgot to teach us in grade school too. If you look in the Machzor, it's not all about sin. I would say Yom Kippur is an emotional roller coaster where you go up and you go down. You go down to sin and all of a sudden you go up. I'll give you a proof. What do we say right before the vidui when we say it together? Right before we say Hashamnu, Bagadnu, and the whole thing. What do we say? It's a song that's well known, as a matter of fact, in most places. I don't know how you sing it here, but I'll say the words. You can probably start singing it. Ki anu amecha ve'ata Eloheinu. How do you sing it? Beautiful. What do those words mean? Anu amecha, we are your nation, ve'ata Eloheinu, and you're our God. Anu vanecha, we're your children, ve'ata avinu, and you're our... What is there? Is there anything about sin there? It's saying, we're great, we're wonderful. God, we may have sinned this year, but hey, we have a pretty good relationship. You know, there's parts of the service that talks about God judging us, b'yom din, who shall live and who shall die. A few seconds later, we talk about v'chol ma'aminim, all that believe. Who believes? We believe. Then it talks about giving God the crown of glory. V'yitin lecha keter melucha. Who gives God the crown of kingship? We do. We go up, we go down. One of my favorite piyutim on Yom Kippur, for reasons beyond me, are not said colloquially in Israel, was said in my yeshiva, starts with the words, Asher omitz tehilatecha. You say it here? You don't remember it before COVID. Yes, before COVID. In the BC years, did you say it? Do you remember? Asher ematcha in Musaf. What does that talk about? It talks about the fact that God has angels in heaven. And they do this and they do that and they're perfect and they're wonderful. And yet God gets his biggest glory from the Jewish people. And who are the Jewish people, says the piyut? Krutzei chomer. They are made of flesh and blood. They have aspirations of eating a good meal, not of eating spiritual heights. They're more excited about a good chulent on Shabbos than they are about a good lecture. And this is who God gets his glory from. It even says the words, Vehi tehilatecha. That's your glory. So the Yom Kippur services go up and go down. Because if you talk about being in unity, then you give the full picture. Namely, we did terrible things this year. We also did wonderful things this year. No one, I think, in this shul can come before God on this Yom Kippur and say, honestly, all I did this year was terrible things. That's the notion of confession in a religion near us. Where you go into a room, you close the door and you say, forgive me, for I have sinned, to a human being. And the gentleman on the other side of the booth says, how much time since your last confession? Now, what does he mean? What does she mean? She means, all I did was sin. I'm not going to talk to you about the good stuff. And then he says, what's how much time since your last confession? How much time since you came to me and talked about how terrible you are? Right? Now, what's the Jewish notion of confession? First of all, what I just said is also the Jewish notion of confession. 50%. What's the other 50%? We read about it 3 weeks ago in the Torah reading. Have you heard of Vidoy Maser? I'll tell you what it is. On the third and seventh year of the Shemitah cycle, you come before God and you say, God, it's been a few years of giving all the tithes to the Kohen, the Levi, the poor person, whatever. Guess what? I did it all right. I'm going to quote the verse for you. Lo arvarti mi mitzvotecha velo shachachti. I didn't violate any of your mitzvot, nor did I forget. That's confession. The Mishnah calls that vidui maser, confession of maser. How is that confession? Says Rav Kook, who says confession is always only about what you did wrong? Maybe confession is also what you did right. Yom Kippur is a day of honesty and unity. Unity with each other and unity with God. So since there's no barriers between us and God, we talk honestly. God, we did a few things this year that are not so good, al-chait. We also did a few things that are pretty good. Who gave you the crown of glory this year? Who perpetuated your name? The name of loving God, kindness. The name of mercy. Who, the Hamas? We did. Who, God, perpetuated the values of the Torah? We did. Yom Kippur is a day where we're at tonal unity and honesty with each other and with God. That's what causes the happiness. We have unity, and therefore we have openness. When you're at unity with someone, and you're not mad at them, you can talk openly. When you can talk openly, it's a very happy conversation. When there's secrets, grudges, things you're hiding, it's not an open conversation. You know, at a chuppah, Ashkenazim, not all, have a custom to go around the bride. The bride goes around the groom, pardon me, 7 times. There's like 25 reasons given for it. I think the basic reason is one. We have one prototype in the Bible of someone that went around something 7 times. What is it?
Joshua.
What happened after he went around 7 times?
The walls fell.
We want to teach a bride and groom to have an open relationship. But just in case there's barriers and secrets and grudges, we're taking down the walls right now.
Okay.
A second before you give her a ring, no walls. Yom Kippur, you come to shul, no walls. Between Jew and Jew, we ask forgiveness. With God, we ask forgiveness. With our family, we've taken care of the relationship. With the sinners, we invite them right in. that everything is unified, and therefore we can talk openly about sin on the one hand, and about the achievements on the other. When a husband and wife have an open relationship with no walls and no secrets, they can sit at a dinner table, and the wife says to the husband, "Listen, I got a parking ticket today." And the husband will say, "Well, it happens. It happens." But if they're mad at each other for other reasons, nothing to do with the parking ticket, and she comes home, or he comes home and says, "I got a parking ticket," it becomes a fight. It becomes the biggest issue in the world. It's like nothing matters anymore. If you're at peace, you can talk openly about the successes and the failures. And that's Yom Kippur. And therefore, Yom Kippur is a day of happiness, because there's no walls between us and God, between each other, and we can talk openly. It's the only day of the year that you indeed can talk openly, because there are no barriers. And that's the happiness of Yom Kippur. And then you're going to look at me and say, "Rabbi, that's very nice. You proved the point." But Yom Kippur is one day of the year. Yom Kippur is the day we're in the Machzer, at the end of the Avodah of the Kohen Gadol, the Grand Kohen, we say, Yom Simat Ahava Reyut, a day where God created Ahava Vereyut. Recognize that from a wedding, love and camaraderie, right? Gila Rina Ditsa Vechedva Ava Veachva Shalom Vereyut. Yom Azivat Kina'ah v'tacharut, a day in which we left behind kina'ah v'tacharut. What's kina'ah? Jealousy. What's tacharut? Competition. Beautiful way to sum up this lecture. Yom Kippur, Yom Azivat kina'ah v'tacharut, the day that we left behind competition and jealousy. But Yom Kippur is one day a year. As they told my son in the army, he just finished, thank God. They used to tell them on Shabbos when they did something wrong, you know, and they can't punish them because it's Shabbos, Jewish army. Tishmu, listen. L'chol Shabbat yesh motzei Shabbat. For every Shabbos, there's a motzei Shabbos. For every Yom Kippur, there's a motzei Yom Kippur. No, what happens on motzei Yom Kippur? We go back home, and we're no longer in unity. You put on your expensive shoes, you put on your cheap shoes, you do this, you do that. You start fouling people, you don't ask for forgiveness. So what good is it? The answer is, Sukkot comes along and tries to tell you to continue that, but in real life, not in shul life, which is a little above and beyond the reality. In reality, what is the sukkah? If not, if you think about it, you can take the most beautiful decorated sukkah, not such a decorated sukkah. At the end of the day, they look alike. 3 to 4 walls, schach, and you're totally at the mercy of the nature of elements, or the elements of nature. Depends how you look at it, right? You can have an expensive home with great air conditioning or great heating. I know here you probably deal more with heating in your sukkah. Where I come from in Israel, we deal more with cooling. But quite frankly, there's no difference. You have your sukkah, sukkah. You can have the most expensive house. The sukkah basically looks the same, just like your shoes look the same on Yom Kippur. Next. You take the lulav, the etrog, adasim, and aravot. What do they symbolize in our tradition? The etrog symbolizes the perfect Jew. He has good deeds, namely he's good to his fellow Jew, and he has mitzvot, his relationship with God. The lulav and the hadasim symbolize the Jew that has one and not the other. And finally, the arava symbolizes one that has none. No mitzvot, and has a terrible relationship with people. You know, the insular guy, this is Masechet Shabbos, and the guy who barely does a mitzvah. What do we do on Yom and Sukkot with these four kinds of Jews? We put them together. The Gemara says about the sukkah, Re'uyin chol Yisrael ha-shevet b'sukkah achad, all the Jewish people could sit in one sukkah. You know, it's amazing in Israel, the ultra-religious Hasidim who have closed their communities to any outsiders because people like me will badly influence their children. I'm a terrible influence, right, Eric?
Yes.
You know that.
I've said that many times.
Yes, yeah. And you're right.
Yeah.
All of a sudden on Sukkot, they do something unprecedented. Last year on the Israeli news, there was a whole 5 minutes on this. And no one can come up with an answer. How come during Sukkot they have something called the Simchat Beit HaShoeva? At night, they dance and they sing in honor of Sukkot. And they open their communities to everyone. So you look at the Simcha Beit HaShoev, I see a lot of chassidim, a lot of strimals, a lot of fur hats, a lot of black. Then you see a guy with a white kippah like me. Then you see a guy with one of those cone kippahs. You know those cone kippahs never sit in your head well? That comes in and dances. And they invite him in. Only on Sukkos. Only on Sukkos. I can explain it. You went through a unifying experience on Yom Kippur. You can't just let that go. On Sukkos, we practice it. The sukkah, the lulav, and the dancing. And what's the height, the climax of these holidays? How do we end them? What is like the final word? You know, right before the time when you can no longer say, talk to me after the Yomim Tovim. That's like the synonym in Israel every time you try to make a meeting at this time of the year. You say, hi Joe, how are you? Chalei HaChagim, after the holidays. After the holidays. Nope. Tell me, what's the day before the after the holidays called? Simcha, Shmini Atzeret, the second to last. Simchas Torah. What do you have to do to be like a Jew who celebrates Simchas Torah? What do you got to do? Do you need to know how to read Hebrew?
No.
No. Do you need to be a learned scholar?
No.
Do you need to know how to be a chazin, a Baal Korah? Do you need to know? What do you need to know? You need to know the two basic things that anyone enjoys. Singing and dancing. Drinking, I'm not so happy. Singing and dancing. I'll say about drinking, if it enhances the simcha, it's great. If it makes you fall asleep and do other things, then it's the opposite. In any case, think about it. If Yom Kippur is a unifying experience, come Simchas Torah, the climax. And all you do is you say, all you got to do is know how to sing and dance. Welcome aboard. No one feels disenfranchised on Simchas Torah. And therefore, I believe that the happiness of Yom Kippur is that we're at unity with each other, with God, to the extent that there's no differences between us for once a year. And we continue that on Sukkos, with the height of it being Simchas Torah. Therefore, I believe that's why the Gemara says this is the happiest day of the year. Yes, we fast. Yes, we don't drink. That only allows us to be in unity with one another, because if that would be part of it, unfortunately, we'd spend part of, if not most of the time, not with each other. But even physically, we're here most of the time and not out there. Once a year, we're in unity, in total unity, to the extent that there's no differences between us. We're a total open relationship with one another, and therefore, it's a happy day. It cancels Shiva. That's what I think the happiness is of Yom Kippur.
Beautiful. Another day after Simchas Torah, we start all over. The walls go back up.
So you see, the day after is always a challenge in Judaism, but it's a challenge in anything. Yeah. If we go back to the bride and the groom, the day after is the biggest challenge for the bride and the groom, because the wedding is joyous, the wedding is beautiful. It's the day later that the challenges begin. To continue, yes, when the bills come in. Yeah. And who's cleaning the floor?
When the bills
and who's putting out the garbage? Yes, that's when the challenge begins. Then it's up to us. Are we going to continue this through the year? Or are we going back to being in total disunity once again? It's really up to us. Then the halacha doesn't help you. This is another lecture that I've given in the past. You can hear it online. I'm going to say it in one sentence. The holiday period is serving God with training wheels. Because we have help. No eating, no drinking. We have help. The day after Simchas Torah is on the two-wheeler without the training wheels. Now try to do it without it.
Yeah, but the
issue fall over or you? Maybe you can
I'll just take a drink, but I want to hear Brian.
But that's the issue. And as Rabbi Bergman pointed out, I think it was this Shabbos, we do everything the same throughout the year, except it's on a spiral, other people said, going up and up. So the notion is that we're supposed to learn something. And in learning something and then putting it into practice, we have the opportunity to not just be the same. We're all the same, then it would be, it could be pointless. But if we incorporate what we've learned, I mean, each Yom Tov is Yom Kippur in particular. Look, you're here, you're assisting us in our congregation by what rabbis do, aside from leading services and life cycle events. You teach. And if you're a good student, quote unquote, you listen. And as you incorporate and learn from many sources, you become better. If you pay attention. You pay attention. Not everybody pays attention, but if you things in different ways, even when Jews don't come to shul, and this, the hope is, as you sort of hinted at, something will inspire something. Who knows what
so
it is?
So I'm going to share with you, based on what Brian just said beautifully, my Ne'ilah speech this year. So I'm ruining it for myself, because if anyone from Montreal is going to be listening, then I am going to bore them at the end of Yom Kippur. And I don't want to do that, but because Brian brought it up, I can't hold myself back, because what he just said is beautiful. Okay? I'm going to buttress what you just said. What do we say in the Avinu Malkeinu? Ben Hashar, we say, Avinu Malkeinu, God, Na'al Teshivenu Rekam Milfanecha, don't let us come back empty-handed before you. What does that mean? We've already asked for this and that and the other thing. What does it mean, empty-handed? What's that, a general statement? We specifically ask for parnasa. We ask for livelihood. We specifically ask for shurfua shlema, to be healthy. What does it mean? Don't come empty-handed. I would like to suggest, you went through this beautiful Yom Kippur. The synagogue was full, the beautiful services, everything I just spoke about, that's very nice. Then you walk out. Are you going to walk out empty-handed? Or is there something that penetrates you that's going to continue out there? What happens if a Jew who's totally impure goes to the mikveh and then comes out and dries himself off? He's no longer wet from the waters of the mikveh. Is he still pure? Of course he is. It had an influence on that Jew. Said Rav Soloveitchik, what happens if a Jew goes to a lecture and then went into this ear and went out that ear? Did it influence him? Something had to stay behind, and he even proves it. When a baby's in the womb of its mother, an angel comes, says the Gemara, and then teaches him the whole Torah. Right before he comes out, he gives him a little something here, and then he forgets it all, right? So why does he even bother? Said Rav Soloveitchik, because something stayed behind. It's impossible you go through this and you come out empty-handed. But that's on one condition, says Brian, that you let it influence you. How many Jews do you know go through the motions without the emotions? I mean, they do everything right. You can't look at them and criticize the way they make Kiddush. They make Kiddush correctly. They have a full cup of wine. They pick it up three tefachim from the table. They say the words. They sit down when they're supposed to sit. They stand where they're supposed to stand. Beautiful. But that means nothing. It means nothing to them. Do you think that's going to perpetuate to the next generation? The next generation says, I don't need to be a trained monkey. Forget it. That's what I think Brian was saying. When we say to God, Na'al Teshivenu Rekam Milfanecha, don't let us come out empty-handed. We would like to continue this out there. What, are we going to leave it behind in shul? So eating and drinking, that we do all year. That's not going to continue outside the synagogue. No. Leather shoes, not going to continue. What about the unity? Can that continue? Maybe it can. Sukkos, we have help. What about the day after Sukkos? It's interesting. The end of every holiday is called something interesting. End of Yom Kippur, which I like to say Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur because they're connected with the 10 days of repentance. We say Ne'ilah. What's Ne'ilah mean? Lock it. Lock it in. Lock in the experience. What do we call the end of Pesach, which goes into the 49 days of the Sefirah to Omer into Shavuos called? What's Shavuos called in our rabbinic language? Atzeret. What's Atzeret mean? You ever go on a bus in Israel? You want the bus to stop? You ring the bell? Atzor. What's Atzor mean? Stop. Let it stop. Let it stay with me. And what's the end of Sukkot called? Shmini. Atzeret. They're all synonyms. We're asking God, God, we went through a beautiful holiday. Is it going to stay behind? And the day after is, oh, too bad the holidays are over. Now we're back to real mundane, boring life? Or no, we went through an experience. Are we the same? Did it influence us or not? I know many Jews that go through the motions without the emotions. Mainly because they're cynical. Mainly because they see importance in nothing. And they do everything right. But then they come out of it empty-handed.
There's a dimension you haven't touched on. You're using the word unity. You're using the word sameness. But yet, at the end of it all, okay, it falls back and the differences come out. But the root has to be respect for the differences and seeing through that to make the unity. So how do you... respect.
100%.
You know,
I have nothing to add. You're right. Okay. It has to be respect for the differences. And that's exactly what I believe is lacking in the Jewish people today.
Yeah.
It's my way or the highway. That's never been the way the Jewish people ran itself. Remember, God made 12 tribes. That wasn't by mistake.
Right. They were all different. Right.
You know how different they were? I'll tell you how different they were. If you were part of the tribe of Shimon, you had your own judicial system. You couldn't go to the tribe of Binyamin if you had a problem with your neighbor. They had unique systems. They were different from one another. The Magen Avraham, who's a Perush on the Shulchan Aruch, is an interpretation of the Code of Jewish Law. He says in the beginning of Laws of Davening, because, you know, in davening, all the bad things come out. You know, shuls bring out the worst in people. They have big fights about nothing. Right? I was at a shul. They told me the biggest fight this year, I mean the biggest fight, is about the following. We add in the Psalm of L'David Hashem Ori. You've heard of it? Yeah? So do you say Kaddish again, or you don't say Kaddish again? Do you combine the Shir Shel Yom with the David Hashem Ori for one Kaddish? You know, you can kill two birds with one stone, or you say two Kaddishes. Huge fight! Big fight! In work, it wouldn't be a big fight. Whatever you want! At home, it wouldn't be. In shul, it brings out the worst in people. Right? Big fight, says the Magen Avraham. Rav Avraham Gumbiner, he was functioning in the 17th century. At his time, he said, there were 12 ways to daven to God. There was Ashkenaz, there was Sfar, there was, I don't know what else. I don't know. I know what there is today. There's Taimani, there's Yemeni, there's Persian, there's this, there's that. But in his time, there were 12. He says there's 12 gates in heaven for the 12 different ways Jews daven. So let's put it in my language. There's Jews that daven long, there's Jews that daven short. There's Jews that dance a lot during davening, and there's Jews that don't sing one song during davening. The problem will be when the Jew that dances and sings says, you don't know how to daven, you have no emotion. And the Jew that never dances and sings during davening says to the Jew that dances and sings, do respect, you're drunk during davening, I'm serious. That's the problem. And I don't understand how that penetrated into Judaism. I don't know when it happened, and I find it terrible.
I think it's always been there.
No, I don't think it's always been there. I think it's not. I think it was there during certain times in Jewish history, and it was unique. But today, it's the commonplace. People sit around the table and say, we're great, which means everyone else is wrong. I don't know where that came from. I feel it's terrible.
Maybe we're suspicious of Bal Yanim, like in the times of that Stukim. You were suspicious that somebody was at Stuki. Today, you're suspicious somebody is...
The Natsif from Volozhin, who died in 1882, has a beautiful piece where he says, in the times of the second base of Mikdash, everyone was suspicious of one another, like the rabbi says, in the name of God. In the name of God. In other words, it's all because I'm so worried about Judaism that I talk against people. And unfortunately, that's happening today. They talk against this kashrus or that kashrus because we care about kashrus. Not because we have anything against the person. We care about kashrus. If you cared about God and you cared about kashrus, you wouldn't talk against kashrus of this guy or that guy. You'd say it's wonderful to have so much kashrus in the Jewish people. It's better than nothing. More than that. Competition breeds better kashrus, not worse kashrus, but no. Today, that's not what happened.
I think the walls come from fear. Talk here, you talk about the spies, and you talk about the tzitzis. I mean,
good point.
That's secure, but okay, whatever.
Good point.
There is a, I can't think of a Greek myth or another tradition. And you can learn things, I think, from other traditions of one sort or another. And the tradition, I can't think of the myth, but she She's given a box. Somebody will
Pandora.
Pandora. Pandora. Thank Pandora. You.
So Pandora has jewelry stores and many of the best malls.
That was just so Pandora, and she's told not to open the box, but she can't. She can't resist. And she opens the box, and all the terrors and all the horribleness flies out of the box into the world and infects the world. In the Greek tradition, this is where all the evil comes from. She slams the box shut, locks, and she hears a little voice, "Let me out! Let me out!" Finally, she says, "Okay, I've let everything else out." She opens it up, and the last thing to come out is hope. And I think the notion, aside from whether it'll be a good year or not a good year, it's the notion we hope that what we've done, that we will be atoned for, and we will be forgiven, and the world might yet be a better place. So in taking that hope out the door in our hands, I think is... aside from, let's see how it all works out.
I think you're right. Hope. If you have hope, you can go through Yom Kippur and become out very optimistic. If you don't have hope, if you're very pessimistic about reality, you can come out of it even more pessimistic, because all you do is talk about sin, and that's what you're going to look at. Usually the people that are very pessimistic will always look at the problems. They'll never look at the achievements. Namely, they get on a plane and they're pessimistic, and the plane took off on time, and they got the seat they wanted, and the service was perfect. What do you think they're going to say when they finish that plane ride?
Thank God I didn't crash.
Something like that. Or, you know, in the pocket in front of my seat, I found the wrapper. That's all they're going to talk about. Yeah. Everything else by the wayside. Someone that's optimistic goes on the plane and says, you know, what a great plane ride. It took off on time. There was good service. I got the seat I wanted. And, you know, the funny thing is someone left a wrapper in that thing. So if you have hope, I think Brian is right. That also can make the difference between Yom Kippur as a happy day and Yom Kippur as a sad day. I don't know. I look around the synagogue on Yom Kippur. I see so many seats filled that are not filled during the year. It fills me with a lot of hope. Because despite everything that's happening in the world, the Jews still come back. Yes, you can always look at the empty seat over there and the person that's missing over there, and that's all you need to talk about. And you can make a big conversation about it. But it gives me a lot of hope to see so many seats filled on Yom Kippur. I think this was a great conversation. Yeah. We talk about how to make Yom Kippur happy. Maybe even more important thing than anything else.
So what were you going to speak about?
This. I don't speak about anything. I speak about where the people are, and I think our conversation was very important for me, and I hope it was for you. Amen. Wishing everyone a Gemar Chatima Tova, a good year. It should be an easy and yet significant fast, and I hope that we come out of it more unified than we went in it. Thank you all very, very much.
Are these favors? Are these?
If you'd like to buy my book, with pleasure. I am actually there.
How much?
$20. Excuse me. Did I say 20? No. I was getting mixed up with another book. My apologies. No. That's my mistake. It's 15. My apologies. 15.
Ask again.
No. I had another book that was 20. My mistake.
Good, Irene.
No.
You
my
just
mistake.
Got excommunicated.
Before Yom Kippur, you don't make mistakes like that. God forbid. God forbid.